I'd also like to say at the beginning, to reiterate something that Elmer said the other day too, although I was listening to a tape by Raymond Keever, and he pointed this out too, that if there's a male tendency toward domination or power, one of the corollaries of that is expertise. And so I guess that's why I read a lot of books and become an expert in this, so I can stand up and say I'm an expert. But I want you to know that a lot of what I'm saying is not the truth, with a capital T, and that we all come to this material with our own biographies and our own experience. And therefore, the status of the knowledge is continuously in flux. It's kind of, what I'm saying is kind of where I am right now, but it's not, I know that's not where I'm going to be. And it's through exchange and discussion and reading that we do amend our points of view on things. And there's also a tendency, I think, for us to want to have an opinion about something. You know, somebody says, well, what do you think about X or Y? And if we don't have an opinion, then we feel this constraint to come up with something. And I know in a lot of the discussions I've had with you on some controversial issues in Christianity and in our lives, that we feel that we hold simultaneous truths or paradoxes, or we tend to believe things that contradict one another. And that's not bad. That's good. There's no reason to make a hasty conclusion or decision saying, well, I'm going to believe this, you know, flip a coin, and it comes up heads, I'll believe this, tails, I'll believe that. There's no reason that it's not possible to hold those paradoxes or contradictions and to wait for insight or further knowledge or revelation or whatever it is that helps one come to terms with those. Are there any, you know, comments or questions about the material I went over last time? I didn't get into the history of what I've called Jehovenism, or what others have called that, as it's come down through the centuries. But it's the point of view as to the dangerousness of sex, and therefore the necessity of tightly controlling it and cornering it, surrounding it with rules, is not something, of course, that we looked at through the ages as being based on Hebrew law so much. The baton is passed through other trends and ideologies, some of them being Hellenist or Greek idealism, the naturalist philosophy of our theology of Aquinas, the writings of Martin Luther and other people in the Protestant Reformation. Do you understand the idea? The basic idea I was trying to get over last time was this connection between the conception of self as being a highly fragile thing that has to be maintained in its pure form and uncontaminated because of the possibility of its change or easily changing it. Yes?
This is kind of a sloppy question, but why was that? The one thing that I wasn't clear about last week was, why was there need for these kinds of rules and controls? And, I mean, culturally?
Yeah, well, I think it has to do with keeping consistent a particular ideology or conception of life, the cosmos, and society, that the infection of a particular self has consequences beyond just the demise of that self or the disintegration of that self. It can branch out and infect the rest of the society and come to, you know, like an epidemic, and come to affect us or the society as a whole.
So the necessity of being a pure people?
Right. Is tied to being a pure self. Pure selves, too.
How did sex then, why was that impure? I mean, I understand that point.
Sex itself is a physical act,
okay,
that infects, I don't want to use that word infects, but it crosses the boundaries of the body. Okay. And remember, the Hebrews are not making this distinction between the body and the mind as much as we make it. So what infects the body or what crosses the boundary of our skin also affects our beliefs and the rest of our life.
I feel like they didn't get a fair shake. I mean, didn't they sense a more good infection, a holy infection? It was such an awesomely good innate thing that it was set aside as something very filled with rules and potential for harm, but that they saw it. If they had any feeling about it, it wasn't that it was associated with dirt, but it was associated with such holiness that it necessitated rules and I don't know, potential for harm or something. But I feel like you're hitting me pretty hard or something for giving us connotations today.
Well, we were doing, you know, sociology in the first session, trying to connect up a lot of what was in Mark with the cultural conditions of the time. And of course, that has to be left in historical debate. But let's face it, you know, these people, they were in a rough situation. Sort of these tribes moving back and forth, the intermarriages. It's not dissimilar to what we see going on today in tribal situations like in Indonesia or New Guinea or just recently in American history, which probably our grandfathers or great-grandfathers and grandmothers still have these memories of raiding parties. You know, you come down and you grab, you know, the Indians come down and they grab the settlers' children and take them off or their wives or this kinds of things. It's the boundaries of society are very important to keep. And that law did function very importantly to maintain an image of a Hebrew society over the years, over time. It still is important to, of course, to Orthodox Jews and to sects within Orthodox Jews. So I'm not putting it down, you know, as something that is nasty and all those kinds of things, but I'm looking at its effects in terms of our feelings and these days and practices about sexuality.
It's funny that you said that, Kevin, because I always thought no one ever came down hard enough on those
issues. Excuse me? Nobody what?
Nobody ever pointed out and made it, helped us to see how bad it was and how it carried up. And you're saying you didn't think they got a fair shake. I'm saying just the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how come no one has talked about that before? And no wonder women were oppressed for so long and all kinds of other things.
Well, the category system in the laws are very intricate, and those categories aren't to be crossed. I didn't even talk about perverted sex. Last time I was talking mainly about what we call normal sex. You see, perverted sex is those things that really cross categories, like sex between the living and the dead, sex between animals and humans, or between different kinds of relations. All of those are extremely bad because they violate the integrity of the self to a much greater extent. Michel Foucault, who's a French sociologist who's enlightened us a lot about how behavior and the administration and control of behavior in the 19th century passed from the church or from religious leaders to other social institutions has also related how sexual behavior and the control of sexual behavior passed from religious leaders or the religious institution to other institutions too. So that we see sex dispersed to medicine, which was probably its primary the primary movement over the understanding and control of sex in the 19th century, and also into the criminal justice system, into pedagogy or education, demography, you know, birth rates and sex control or birth control, those types of things, biology, and psychiatry. A friend of mine told me when I told him what I was going to talk on up here at Holden, he forced this on me. He wanted me to be sure to share this, so I will. This is something like a home medical advisor that came out in the 19th century by a guy named J.H. Kellogg. who happens to be the individual that also invented Kellogg's Corn Flakes, and as being a health food. And this is called Plain Facts for Old and Young, Science of Human Life. Well, in the 19th century, with the when the sexual repression got into all many of the major institutions that I just mentioned, Foucault attaches this to, in sort of a Marxist materialistic way, to the development of industrialization. And he points out that so many other areas of life became rationalized, put into a logical form, especially we see in terms of time. You know, and if you've all gone to regular schools, and you see the importance of time. You know, you're there at 8:02, if that's when it starts. If it's 8:02 and 10 seconds, you're late. You know, and you try to you know, and work, and all of these things are timed, and where people live. And the whole thing about making a city, planning cities so that people move in and out of work, and where they live, and putting factories here and there. All of this in terms of production, or maximizing production. Why shouldn't sex be one of these areas, too? It becomes tightly controlled in terms of a rationality toward making production more efficient. Before I read this, this is an aside. I was telling somebody this the other day. One of my department chairmen one time had been working in personnel in a factory in North Carolina, when the guy that was in charge of efficiency, the time man, you know, decided to find out in a secret way. This is, you know, the guy must have been a sociologist, because they tend to think about these things too, how to study people without them knowing it, you know. So he drained all the sumps in the factory on a weekend, and then the people came to work, and then the next day they looked in the sumps to see what was in there, what had people thrown away, you know, to find out what they're doing instead of working. And he found a lot of condoms, you know. It's the part of the sewer, you know, it goes into there and then it drains out into the ground or someplace else. So they found a lot of condoms in there. And so it's, you know, flabbergasted people that sex was going on during work, you know, and of course that kept production down. A certain kind of production. But so if these people are going to be going around, it's easier to control, obviously, interpersonal sex, because if you control women, you know, that was like when I was going to college, that was the big thing. You know, if you controlled the women and made sure where they were all the time, then you knew that the men would, and that's all you had to do, because the men would, you know, would be safe too then, at least from having sex with women.
The school I went to, I just love it. They had a curfew, 12 o'clock, just for the women.
Yeah. So well, they were particularly...
We could go all night, but, yeah.
Well, of course, the big bugaboo comes about people, you know, treating themselves in a way, or masturbation. And how does one control that? Because that's essentially a secret activity, and nobody, unless people are crazy, they're not going to be doing that in public. And so masturbation becomes the primary sexual perversion in the 19th century, and it is the thing that is blamed for all of these kinds of psychosomatic illnesses or behaviors. Bad habits of various kinds. It becomes what they call in medicine the panopathogen. It's the thing that causes all evil. So this friend of mine, who Elmer knows, liberated this book from the Lutheran Church of Nigeria. Because he wanted to preserve the mental health of Nigerians. And so, what they call it in this chapter here is called self-abuse. And signs of self-abuse. And these are things, you know, parents can watch out for. But listen to them, you know, and you'll realize that what they're talking about in essence is something like original sin. You know, like nobody can be free from these symptoms, so everybody is going to be suspected. General debility, coming upon a previously healthy child, marked by emaciation, weakness, and, you know, I won't read this whole thing. Early symptoms of consumption, or what are supposed to be such, as cough and decrease in flesh, with short breathing and soreness of the lungs or muscles of the chest. Often the result of this vice. Premature and defective development is a symptom closely allied to the two preceding, when it cannot be traced to such natural causes as overstudy, overwork, lack of exercise, and other influences of a similar nature, it should be charged to self-abuse. Sudden change in disposition is a sign which may well arouse suspicion. A boy who has previously been cheerful, pleasant, dutiful, and gentle suddenly becomes morose, cross, peevish, irritable, and disobedient, be sure that some foul influence is at work with him. Lassitude is unnatural for a child as for a young kitten. And, you know, it goes on.
Yeah. Does this talk about men? It doesn't talk about women?
Yeah, it does too. In connection with the preceding symptom will generally be found, instead of that natural brilliancy of expression in the eyes and countenance, an unnatural dullness and vacantness. Sleeplessness, failure of mental capacity, fickleness, untrustworthiness, love of solitude, bashfulness. 12 and 13 are really, you know, this is the kind of thing you can't escape this, because 12 is bashfulness and 13 is unnatural boldness. Uh, 14, mock piety, or perhaps we should more properly designate it as mistaken piety, is another peculiar manifestation of the effects of this vicious practice. The victim is observed to become transformed by degrees from a romping, laughing child full of hilarity and frolic to a sober and very sedate little Christian. The friends think, and they are highly gratified with the piety of the child. Easily frightened, confusion of ideas, sudden aversion to the society of girls, that's for boys, of course, round shoulders, weak backs, pains in the limbs and stiffness of the joints, paralysis of the lower extremities, the gait becomes affected, bad positions in bed, lack of development of the breasts in females, capricious appetite, fondness of the unnatural, hurtful, and irritating foods. I think Kellogg was eating clay, slate pencils, plaster, chalk.
Eating that stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't mention paste. Disgust for simple food. The use of tobacco is good presumptive evidence that a boy is also addicted to a practice still more filthy. So you know what's worse than tobacco smoking. Unnatural paleness and colorness of the lips, acne or pimples, biting the fingernails. There's also some that are peculiar to females, like hysteria in females, and so on. Then there's a section on results of secret vice. But, you know, how far, if you want to control this, you know, it's, what?
When was that written?
In the 19th century sometime. But I have another text, or another source that talks about this too, that was published in 1902. So I think it was pretty common up until probably World War II. The problem about stamping out vice, of course, is that vice is what criminologists call a victimless crime. In other words, our criminal justice system depends on the fact that somebody is hurt and they'll report the crime to the police. If there's nobody that sees himself as losing money or property or being harmed physically, there's nobody to report the crime to the police. So how do the police control vice? And that's where you get into the problems of civil liberties and First Amendment rights and those types of things. So how can you control this and wipe it out? You know, it becomes really difficult and subject for a lot of cleverness. For example, he mentions that Dr. Archibald, superintendent of the Iowa Iowa Asylum for Feeble-Minded Children. I wish there probably was a refuge. We have become acquainted with the method of treatment of this disorder, which is applicable in refractory cases, and we have employed it with entire satisfaction. This is Dr. Archibald is saying this. It consists in the application of one or more silver sutures in such a way as to prevent erection. The prepuce or foreskin is drawn forward over the glands, and the needle to which the wire is attached is passed through from one side to the other. After drawing the wire through, the ends are twisted together and cut off close. It is now impossible for erection to occur, and the slight irritation that produced such acts as a most powerful means of overcoming the disposition to resort to the practice. In females, the author has found the application of pure carbolic acid to the clitoris an excellent means of allaying the abnormal excitement and preventing the recurrence of the practice in those whose willpower has become so weakened that the patient is unable to exercise entire self-control.
This author married?
What's that?
Was the author married? Author's a sadomasochist.
Carbolic acid.
This is the same guy who makes money at the cornflakes I eat every day.
I guess he used to.
Probably died of self-abuse.
Next time.
This is
more than
wires.
With the invention, so to speak, of the cornflakes, that is his idea about certain foods that would lead you to his
diminish
so
sexual.
So it was really that had to do with his whole development of the cornflakes.
Saltpeter.
It's supposed to decrease your sexual drive.
Yeah, somebody was pointing out that was the same. Same with the graham crackers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
They put salt in graham crackers?
No.
That's
sorry. Okay, I'm hearing two conversations.
Carbolic acid.
What do you mean, graham crackers? Well, this leads into...
that's really incredible.
What it makes me think, though, is that this other article we had is Stephen George. Some of those things don't sound too far as weird.
No.
At least they don't hurt.
In fact, you know, that's...
that's
sort of a lead-in to a discussion of the ideology of Gnosticism, which is, in its form, in terms of sexual ideology, is practically a reverse mirror image of the Jehovenist point of view. I would like a couple of people to look up a couple of Bible verses. Who still has their Bible? Alana, could you look up 1 Timothy 6:20? Anybody else? Which translation do you have? Is anybody who has the new or the English? Oh, Greg, could you look up 1 Corinthians 7, 29-31. How many of you have heard of the term Gnosticism or Gnosis? I took a religion class in college at PLU in which it was talked about as being a heresy of the early church. It was a religion that competed with Judaism and Christianity in the early days of Christianity. And it's mentioned in the Timothy text. Who looked that one up? Do you have that one? No.
1 Timothy 6:20.
Right.
O Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you. Avoid the godless chatter and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. For by professing it, some have missed the mark as regards to faith. Praise be with you.
Yeah, the knowledge there that's talked about is the gnosis, the Greek word for knowledge. The heresy was that was based on an understanding of the spirit world, that we don't have in, as part of our religious beliefs in either Christianity or Judaism. This book by Hans Jonas, The Gnostic Religion, he looks at some of the older documents about Gnosticism, and there's very little direct evidence or documents left because it obviously it lost the battle. And like a lot of ideologies this way, when they lose the battle, we lose the texts, or we lose the writings too. Nobody keeps those up. So most of what we know about Gnosticism is from writings of early Christians or Hebrews about this time. But I wanted to give you sort of an understanding of what's missing from our religious tenets that seems to be the pull of Gnosticism. In his preface, he talks about the Sistine Chapel and the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And if you're acquainted with Da Vinci's depictions, it starts with creation. That's where the story begins for us, humans and God in that relationship. And then the depictions of what happens to that covenant and the various important points through history. But the question is that Jonas asks, and that is central to Gnosticism, is what was happening before that? What was happening before creation? What was going on in the heavens and in hell? And how that's obviously revealed knowledge. There's no way that we don't have any access to documents that talk about that. But here's some of the drama that could be involved. He talks about a different kind of ceiling in the Sistine Chapel where these other events would be depicted. And he says the stage would be the same, the theme is transcending, the creation of the world, the destiny of man, fall and redemption, the first and the last things. But how much more numerous would be the cast, how much more bizarre the symbolism, how much more extravagant the emotions. Almost all the action would be in the heights, in the divine or angelic or demonic realm, a drama of pre-cosmic persons in the supernatural world, of which the drama of man in the natural world is but a distant echo. And yet that transcendental drama before all time, depicted in the actions and passions of manlike figures, would be of intense human appeal, divinity tempted, unrest stirring among the blessed eons, God's erring wisdom, the Sophia falling prey to her falling, wandering in the void and darkness of her own making, endlessly searching, lamenting, suffering, repenting, laboring her passion into matter, her yearning into soul, a blind and arrogant creator, believing himself the Most High and lording it over the creation, the product like himself of fault and ignorance, the soul trapped and lost in the labyrinth of the world, seeking to escape and frightened back by the gatekeepers of the cosmic prison, the terrible archons, a savior from the light, a savior from the light, beyond, venturing into the nether world, illuminating the darkness, opening a path, healing the divine breach, a tale of light and darkness, of knowledge and ignorance, of serenity and passion, of conceit and pity, on the scale not of man, but of eternal beings that are not exempt from suffering and error. And that's the story that these Gnostics were telling at that particular time. The threat of Gnosticism was that it wholly dismissed the world as sort of an accident and a prison in which the soul finds itself. And so that our relationship or our duty, our virtue, for example, is meaningless because it's the world and the creation and society imprisons us. And you see how the weight of the law and the depictions of the interests of the Pharisees and other Jewish sects and so on weigh on the individual, and they sense themselves to be imprisoned. The covenant relationship between the Hebrews and God has to do with maintaining a law in order to benefit society. or for the benefit of society. You as a people will prosper. Where's the individual in that? It's not that the promise isn't given to individuals. It's given to the Hebrews as a people. And that is where their focus should be. But within all of us, there's this spark, this wanting to be free from that. We want to rebel against that, social restrictions, or we see it in terms of the authorities, our parents, or the police, or other gatekeepers of the society. And who has not felt that they wish they could be free just to wreak their own will on things? Where does that spark come from? Where does that sense of freedom come from? The Gnostics were saying it comes from the real God, the true God, that's beyond the religion or the creation as we know it, that's out there someplace, beyond several heavens. They had this image of course, layers of heavens and hell before you get to earth or before you get to human existence. And the true God is way out there someplace and beyond understanding and doesn't care too much about human beings. And then the light that comes from that God is diffused down through all those layers. And it's like when you see the sun or the moon on moving water, you see, or on the snow, you see all these little sparks of the diffused light. And so each of us has one of those little sparks in us. And that is that spark that we feel toward wanting to be reunited with our true, with the true God, the real, all-important God, of which the creator God of the Hebrews and the God of the Christians is really a malevolent, non-connected part, one that likes to do us evil and that we have to escape from. So how do we escape? And this is where the theology of Gnosticism and the moral connectedness to that philosophy gets passed down through the centuries and becomes known as a libertine philosophy. We assert our freedom by going against the law. We assert our freedom by going against nature. The Gershom Scholem, who has written a book called Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, has traced this philosophy down from the Middle East in the Middle Ages to connections in Europe with the Enlightenment. Some of the writings of that time reflect this philosophy, this libertine philosophy, specifically the memoirs of Casanova, the opera by Mozart, Don Giovanni, and specifically, probably most important, the writings of the Marquis de Sade. Now, one of the articles I had you read, I think was probably pretty tough for you, was Nature as Destructive Principle, which was a commentary on the writings of the Marquis de Sade. There's a resurrection of this philosophy around 1900 with a book by Huysmans called Against Nature. The French poet Baudelaire, the English writer Swinburne, and Oscar Wilde, among others. From the 1960s, there's a lot of this philosophy within the writings of the Beatniks, and French authors like Georges Bataille and Jean Genet, and Pauline Réage, which is a pseudonym for somebody. That was the one person who wrote the story of O. Within the United States, this philosophy is carried out within some of the writings of Norman Mailer, Lenny Bruce, who was a comedian, William Burroughs, who wrote an influential book called Naked Lunch, John Retchie, who wrote the book City of the Night, or City of Night, and Marco Vassi, who wrote The Saline Solution, is carried on within Hustler magazine. And the aggressive bisexuality of rock stars like Mick Jagger, Alice Cooper, groups like the Sex Pistols, and Tim Curry, who is the star of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and in general, punk rock. All of them have this idea that to free one, that one has to find one's true self by freeing oneself from the strictures and the norms of and customs of everyday society, the things that control us. So, yes.
I don't quite see how you jump from talking about the Gnostic myth and then into this more libertine.
Okay.
Promoting the libertine.
Well, let's look at the other, maybe it would be clear if we looked at the other Bible verse, or verses. The 1 Corinthians 7, 29 to 31.
What I mean, my friends, is this. The time we live in will not last long. While it lasts, married men should be as if they had no wives. Mourners should be as if they had nothing to grieve them. The joyful as if they did not rejoice. Buyers must not count on keeping what they buy, nor those who use the world's wealth on using it to the full. For the whole frame of this world is passing away.
It kind of reminds me of the movie Harold and Maude in some respects. You know, Maude's uncaring attitude about property, especially automobiles and traffic laws. If the world is passing away, her world is passing away, then what sense does it make to follow all these rules and strictures that bind one to this world, or that only make sense in terms of a virtuous society where people recognize the limits and the rights of others and the dignity of others. The two major reactions to Gnosticism in terms of morality are the ascetic, which may make more sense. You know, if the world is, if this world and the heavens, as has been taught to us, are meaningless, and in fact opposed to us, then let's separate ourselves from the world as much as possible and become an ascete. But then there's this other branch too, the libertine branch, that says if these premises are true, then what sense does it make to go along with the world's strictures, and in fact we free ourselves from those by rebelling against them, and we find our true self over against society. The Hebrews, of course, this religion was probably a tremendous great threat to them, and you can see how the Savior from the light, Jesus, coming into this world to tell us that the law is to be replaced or doesn't or shouldn't be controlled over us. This easily fit into this Gnostic religion. But the major threat for the Hebrews would be that the transcendental aspect, that truth and our orientation jumps over all these levels of the cosmos, way off into where God is, and one orients oneself toward that God. What sense does morality make, or cultivating virtue, cultivating a respect for the law, and what kind of morality comes out of this religion? To the Hellenists, the Neoplatonists, all the philosophers and the Hebrews and all of that at this time, there was no morality in it, and that was what a major threat was. But you can see that there is a morality, but it's a reverse morality, and saying now it frees me to do evil and think I'm pursuing the good by doing evil. Does that make it clear?
Yeah.
That's to do good if the system I guess it's what we consider the system as being good or as not being good, right?
Well,
if we,
but ask yourself this, what would humans be like without a society or culture? It's impossible to conceive,
right?
Because there are no humans. I mean, there is no such thing. And wherever you find humans, you find culture and society. Even among hermits, you know, there's a sense of they bring part of their culture with them. And so what would humans be like in a pure form, unadulterated form? That's really difficult to say. So all society and culture restricts that particular ideal view. But I suppose the more repressive society would be, the more people would feel a need to rebel. And I think, you know, that this is also part of the interest in perverted sex or pornography, you know, those kinds of things, to see what's not been seen before. There's an aggressive, hostile element involved. Obviously, you see, the Gnostics see sex as evil. It can destroy the self and society. But they're saying it should. You know, that's the program. Splitting sex becomes the primary vehicle in modern Gnostic thought or morality. Sex becomes the primary vehicle for splitting off the false self from the true. Death is probably even a greater way to do that, but there's a natural inclination, I think, not to desire one's own extinction, and also the extinction of others gets pretty difficult too. But to abuse people and dominate people sexually, and to humiliate people, becomes one capacity for finding one's finding the truth in a sense, sort of going against common understandings or social understandings of the right and the good. The story of O, which I was talking about the other day, is a modern classic in this respect, because O, the story of the book, the plot of the book, is how every element of herself is peeled away through humiliation, being gagged, she loses her speech, being blindfolded, she loses her sight, until supposedly comes this person emerges that is totally free from any social teaching restrictions, just an object, a pure sexual object. Gnostics or libertines tend to really be interested then in crossing these categories that the Hebrews pointed out as being true examples of perverted sex. So you find a lot of interest in sex between humans and animals, children, child pornography, virgins, the use of virgins, sex with freaks, or people that are just, you know, would repulse us normally, prostitutes. One author goes so far as to say, you know, like a pornographic movie house could be the church, you know, if you look at it this way, of the Gnostics. And likewise, you have people sitting there in rapt attention looking at what's going on and then relating that to their own sex lives, their own past life, present, and maybe future sex life. Then you find other porno movie houses where people are really involved, you know, laughing, cheering, clapping, you know, those kinds of things. Let's see. So the goal, of course, as I said earlier, is, just to sum up in a way, is knowledge. So censorship becomes a plot to prevent this knowledge from coming about. Censorship doesn't allow us to have access to this kind of knowledge that would allow us to break through a repressive and an evil social order that's been forced upon us. some, the feeling, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but so it's, I think it's, I had this feeling one time when I was confronted with an incredibly gorgeous drag queen. And it made me realize how my categories of thought that I had come from, or where I had come from, really didn't allow me to understand this at all, or to deal with it. Here's, you know, a drag queen crosses these categories of male, female, and dress, and so on. And to find someone that's deliberately doing this and can carry it off so beautifully.
Can you explain what drag queen for
Anna? It's a man who dresses in women's clothing in such a way as to, you know, almost become a parody of beauty in a way, and to parody I can't think of the right word, but sort of a kind of essence of feminism, which is beauty, dependence, and so on. You know what I'm talking about now.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody that...
But I think, is it a parody on the feminine, or is it, you know, going along with and stressing the feminine?
Right. Well, I think it has to do with one's own consciousness that one looks at as what one looks at. Because I tend to see drag queens as trying to epitomize a particular view of femininity better than women probably can.
Mm-hmm. Or want to.
Or want to, yeah.
In Thailand, they have whole shows that do this. The men take hormones. You cannot tell. I mean, they are beautiful. They're the epitome of feminine in action and appearance.
What?
I just emphasized the view of feminism.
Right. It's really depraved. You know, on one level, it's so depraved, but on the other level, it's astonishing. And the point is that it throws a glaring light on a lot of the absurdity of the distinctions that we make. And I think, you know, the feminist movement has brought this out in many ways too. How, for example, we take these myths of the male and female, and that exist in the universe. You know, we divide up emotions into female emotions and male emotions. But then the mistake is to say that these the myth of the male and female should be or are actually assigned to real men and women. You know, as if there can be no cross-categorizations. And so, am I living up to this male ideal of some archetype, which is thought of as a way of organizing the universe? Probably not even meant to relate to me as a real human being. I mean, you know, and I'm not supposed to emulate that form as a real human being. But those emotions are available to everybody, the male and the female emotions. And they can be cultivated in everybody, not depending on what one's actual gender is. So you see where the Jehovenists and the Gnostics both see sex as evil, but then the prescription is different. The Jehovenists say, let's repress it, you know, and control it. And the Gnostics say, let's use it as a battering ram to knock down society and to change things.
There are libertarians or Gnostics who don't view sex that way. They use some other things, or is this just a... I mean, that to me, it seems like the Gnostics or the libertarians are a real small minority rather than a lot.
I would say so. You know, they have their... there's various branches, obviously, and it's been totally secularized, I think, too. You know, but it isn't aimed at a god, maybe, except as God is used as a battering ram against people who do things differently or are different. But there are, you know, like porno collectors. You know, there's people who have vast collections of pornography, and they want to, you know, like they collect butterflies. I mean, like people collect butterflies or stamps, you know, something like they want to get this species and that kind. That they really enjoy seeing how these categories are crossed. Then there's the high prophets or prophetesses of Gnosticism, the authors, the people that are probably the first to be censored. There's people that venture out into those the edge of what's socially possible, come back and tell us what it's like. I think, you know, a lot of youth culture is, if we could look at an ideology as being, any ideology, you have people that are at the core of it, that really promote it and live by it. And then you have different groups of people that are further away from that core. And then I think probably youth culture is on the outside of this core of Gnosticism, that it's kind of a nice way to rebel against society. You can listen to rock and roll music and you're not going to be thrown in jail. And you know, people say, well, look at the lyrics of that music, you know, those kids must really believe that. But they don't want to overthrow society. You know, they can listen to it and maybe feel that some of that spark of freedom of going against strictures that their parents have taught them. But they can easily come back again. We welcome them back when they get to be 21. Yeah. or clothes, you know, fashions in youth culture. There are, whatever, you know, you find, so people with our youth orientation in our society, you find adults copying the fashions of youth. But as soon as they copy those, the youth have to change quick, you know, and then people find themselves out, the adults find themselves out of step again. So, you know, then when, is that kind of like what you were getting at? Yeah.
Is there any theological base to libertine philosophy other than going against the strains of modern culture, popular culture? What is the... What's the
well? Let's look at it this way. As an analogy, maybe Martin Luther. You know, where he's going to free people from the authoritarian structures that are enclosing their lives and turning them into zombies. I mean, that's a real exaggeration of Catholic faith at that time. But so in the name of the God of the Old and the New Testament, in the name of Jesus Christ and the writings of the Bible, he frees people from those authoritarian structures. So there, you know, what is the theology? It could be even that kind of a theology, that we want people to act in terms of their own understandings of their own religious destiny, and to make decisions on their own rather than just follow things because they're forced to. Maybe it's important for people to be tempted and to commit what might be evil or understood as evil, so that people can come to terms with that in themselves. I guess, you know, the temptations of Jesus might be an example of that, which you were preaching on last Sunday. If one never has the opportunity, how will one know what one would do? That's part of the tyranny of the state, you know, is to say, I'm not going to give anybody the opportunity to masturbate, nobody the opportunity to use marijuana or heroin or any other interdicted drug, because I'm scared of the choices they might make. So it's better that they just not have the opportunity. And then maybe you've asked yourself this too, if I ever did have the opportunity, and maybe a lot of us see our lives this way too in terms of grace, you know, that we've been blessed by the grace of never having the opportunity to do some things because we don't know what we might have done. And there's this song, "There But For the Grace of God Go I." So I don't know if that helps with the kind of theology that you're looking for.
Well, the what I learned, the article I read about Marquis de Sade and naturalism, what the question I kept coming up with is that do these people see any value in society, or is all society have no value, so I must slam that? They brought up later in the article about Nietzsche and the concept of samsara, and that all the there's an eternal return of the same thing. Nothing ever changes in society. Everything eternally returns the same. And I asked myself how thinking people could see that, because obviously things evolve.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about that article. The point of the article is that is to trace Sade's thought as he tries to come to terms with some of the problems of this philosophy. And why was he anti-God? They pointed out at the beginning of the article that he wasn't atheistic in terms of like philosophical atheism. He found it necessary to believe in God, but why? Does anybody remember? Why would God be necessary for the gospel? What?
The problem is more that I thought that assignment was for Thursday.
Yeah. Okay. Well, from what I said about Gnosticism, though, why are the Gnostics anti-God? Right. God is seen as evil, who created us to play with us and visit all kinds of suffering on us.
But that's not the true God, though, right?
Right. But I think that's the original Gnosticism, is to say that that this creator God is an evil God, that's not the supreme God.
Okay.
But I don't know if De Sade was thinking about that so much. Obviously, then, anti-morality is trying to cut away at this God, get back at him. So it's like why shouldn't I act toward others like God has acted toward me? And it can get, really heretical, you know, or difficult arguments for Christians to come to terms with. We've dealt with this delicately, like this problem of good and evil. If we ask ourselves, why did God do that to us? Put us in that position, tempt us, like in the Garden of Eden. And what difference is God always maintains his power over us, a power relationship, and we can't forget that we're subordinate. Then shouldn't we treat other people that way too? How do other people know that they're poor or powerless unless we treat them that way? I don't know whether you've ever thought about that or not, but that's how powerless people know they're powerless, is that they're exploited and used. So shouldn't we help them, you know, be powerless? If that's where they are, and that's what how God created us. What the problem for De Sade, of course, was about this time the Enlightenment is going on strong too, and these people are replacing this notion of God, as it points out in that article. They're saying it's not that kind of God anymore. You know, it's more of a deist understanding of God, that the world and the cosmos run according to certain principles, the laws of nature, and we can't escape those. So it isn't, you know, that we don't act or societies reflect what they do, because necessarily because God has commanded us, but because we're all subjects of nature. And that's where most of that article is trying to come to terms with this, is how does one go against nature? And there's the problem that, that nature seems to create and destroy, that nothing lasts. And so if we go around destroying things, aren't we helping nature out? Aren't we doing nature's will? What would happen, you know, if there weren't murders and wars and all those sorts of things? Nature would have to visit other things on us to get rid of, you know, a lot of life. Life is always this notion of perpetual motion, that matter never stops. I mean, when your body dies, the elements of what your body are made up of move on into other things too, become recreated in new forms. New forms of life, or new forms of what we call inanimate objects.